Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. Today on Inflection Point, one of the ways people used to find themselves was to join the Peace Corps after college. Now there's a way to do that before college.
This is not a year about going out to do good. It's a year fundamentally about re-envisioning yourself and figuring out what role you want to play over the course of your lifetime and really making a dent.
Finding yourself. That's our inflection point. In 2015, 3 million students were expected to head to college for the first time. Yet according to the latest study from ACT, which measures the academic achievement of 11th and 12th graders, only 36% chose a major that fit their interests. And the National Center for Education reports that in 2013, only 59% actually got their diploma from college. Our guest, Abby Falick, is the founder of Global Citizen Year, a program that offers students an alternative to this traditional college model. Welcome, Abby.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us what Global Citizen Year is.
Global Citizen Year, the organization I founded and now have the privilege of leading, is reimagining education. We're on a mission to make it normal that kids from all backgrounds choose a global bridge year between high school and college, an opportunity to live and work in other parts of the world, to learn who they are, what they care about, and to be prepared to approach higher education with a clearer sense of purpose and much more deliberate idea about why they're in school and how they can use school to further their passions.
How does it work?
I've been dreaming this up since I was 18 and looking for it, and it didn't exist. And ever since, I've really been fascinated by the missed moment of opportunity in American education, this conveyor belt that moves kids from K through 16 without any encouragement to pause and to learn outside of the classroom context. And so the CORE program for us is an opportunity to recruit and train a really diverse core of young people as they come out of high school and they come through a school year-long program with us where they live and work in Asia, Africa, Latin America, living with a host family, working as apprentices. They may be teaching assistants. They might be an extra set of hands in a public health facility or working on an agriculture project, but all very much in the service of helping them explore who they are when they are outside of their comfort zone, redefining their identity, and again, unlocking this sense of purpose for their higher education. The vision, again, is that this someday becomes the normal pathway, the common expectation. And as an organization, we're working actively with partners across all sectors to figure out what it'll take to create a cultural shift so that someday a Global Citizen Year before college is the new rite of passage in America.
What's it take for a high school graduate to be successful in a program like this?
So we're looking for somewhat unusual traits. We're not, we have an admissions process and we're quite selective, but we're not so interested in kids' test scores or grades in the same way that a college might be. We're looking for a spark of potential. We're looking for young people who have seen a need or an opportunity and gathered resources to make something happen. For kids who've been able to persuade others to follow their lead in whatever that might have been. And so we're looking at motivation, drive, and resilience. And that over time, that's what we've seen to be the key seeds that enable a young person to take best advantage of the Global Citizen Year experience. And I'll say that, you know, our high schools are just doing a terrible and worsening job of preparing young people for college and for the world. The high school model hasn't changed in 100 years. And, you know, the fact that computers are already outperforming humans on cognitive functions suggests that we need to dramatically re-envision the role of education in the world, and that education needs to be focused on unlocking the things that are unique about being human: empathy, curiosity, resilience, collaboration, critical thinking, entrepreneurial spirit, creativity. And these are not any of the words I think we would use to describe what's happening in most high schools in America. And then kids get to college exhausted because they've been on this treadmill for so long. You know, there's a notion of a race to some undefined end point. And today, nationally, a third of college freshmen don't come back for a second year. And this is because rates of depression, anxiety have just skyrocketed. And we know that those things come about when somebody doesn't have a clear sense of purpose or the sort of self-awareness or self-confidence to know what they're doing there in the first place. There's something really broken. America leads the world in college dropout.
Really?
Among developed nations. And then for the lucky few who sort of make it through and figure out how to get through, on average, kids take 6 years to get through four-year institutions. And if you happen to be low income or first in your family to go to college, just 8% of kids are actually completing a college degree. And so for those who make it through, it's a pretty dire situation as well, where 90% of employers say that those kids are actually not prepared for a global economy. And so there are these disconnects and these moments to think outside of the traditional bounds of this sort of high school to college continuum that need to take center stage when we think about what today's young people need to learn and where and how they're going to learn it.
Is the model similar to the Peace Corps?
In some ways, yeah. And in fact, when I was 18, I was hungry for something like this, and I called the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps said, go to college, we'll see you in 4 years, which at the time was very frustrating, but which I now understand very well. The Peace Corps is oriented towards sending young people, now college graduates and older, out into the world to be of service, to apply skills and education in the service of communities around the world. Our program is very deliberately focused on the developmental stage and transition of an 18-year-old, where this is a moment for them to learn themselves in the world. We think of it as a foundation that they can then build on over the course of their lives. But we're very explicit that this is not a year about going out to do good in the world. It's not a year of service. It's a year fundamentally about re-envisioning yourself, understanding how the world works, and figuring out what role you want to play over the course of your lifetime in really making a dent.
Well, you talked about the graduation rates for various communities, including underserved communities, and the particularly low graduation rate for that. What's the accessibility for this program like for communities of all incomes?
So at Global Citizen Year, we've been fundamentally committed from the beginning to making sure that kids from all backgrounds have access to this opportunity. We are on a mission to build a new generation of global leaders. And in order to do that, we need to make sure that those young leaders reflect our country's diversity. And that's our racial diversity, geographic diversity, and socioeconomically is fundamentally important as well. Traditionally, programs like ours have not been accessible to kids outside of a select group who happen to have grown up in privilege. And so one of the things we have focused on and the reason we're set up as a 501c3 not-for-profit is so that social impact can be the bottom line and we can admit the strongest candidates we can find irrespective of their financial background. So to date, 80% of our kids have received financial aid. 30% have received a full need-based scholarship that we raise through philanthropic partners and support. And it's one of the things I think we're most proud of as an organization is that each year we're building a cohort that truly reflects our country's diversity.
Once a kid gets accepted into your program, is there training that they undergo before they head off to work in these different countries?
Yeah, we think of the whole arc of the 10 months that they're with us. It maps to a school year as an intensive training program, a leadership training. It starts and ends with a boot camp in the Bay Area. So we kick off with a week of training at Stanford University before they then travel to their country posts. And we bring in experts and inspiring speakers. So whether it's an introduction to mindfulness, an orientation around global development, social innovation, authentic leadership. One of the things that this allows us to do as well is not only prepare kids for what they're going to encounter, but connect them to the cohort that's coming together from around the country. And this year, for the first time from around the world, 20% of this year's class came from other countries, which just adds a whole new dimension of diversity to the work that we're doing. But it's an opportunity for them to feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves. It's a call to something that's not just their independent experience, but that they feel like they're connected to a network and they're in it together. And I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen such high rates of continuation and success in the program, is that each of our fellows feel like they are in it again, not just for themselves, but because they owe it to the rest of the cohort to really make the most of this extraordinary opportunity.
What are some of the countries where your programs are?
So we currently operate in 4 countries. We have a program in Brazil, Ecuador, Senegal, and have just launched a new model in India, where we're partnered with Teach for India. And all of our fellows in India this year will be working as teaching assistants across Teach for India's classrooms.
Do the students need to be able to speak the language of the countries they're visiting?
So we've made a decision not to require a foreign language as a prerequisite for admission to the program, largely because our high schools do a terrible job of teaching foreign language. And so if it were a requirement, it would mean that we're just selecting kids who happen to have been at, you know, leading private schools where they happen to have had the opportunity to learn another language. And so rather than fight that fight, we make it accessible to kids coming from all types of educational backgrounds. We have a partnership with Rosetta Stone. So over the summer before our fellows travel, they have an opportunity to get up to a very, very baseline level of comfort in the language. And then once they arrive in country, we do a deep immersion in language. We work with local universities and they have ongoing training and tutoring so that by the end of their year, they come back proficient to fluent in a foreign language and one that's going to be critical and useful for them over the course of their lives.
I'm thinking about this from 2 perspectives. I'm thinking about it from the perspective of being a parent and the idea that my child might go away to college or to another program out of high school is completely terrifying to me.
Yes.
That they will no longer be in my sight, so let alone to a foreign country.
Yeah.
So how do parents get involved in this, and how do they get brought on board?
You know, it's funny. I hear you say that, and I hear this all the time, and then I have to think, well, and why is it that we're comfortable sending our kids to a freshman dorm?
Well, I feel the same way about the freshman dorm as I do about sending my child to another country.
As the first step out of the home, as though the freshman dorm is the place where we want kids to get oriented toward adulthood and sort of develop a compass and a set of values.
Yeah.
I'm a new mom myself, and I think as soon as I had my son, I had a whole new appreciation for the trust that our parents have had in us and the courage, really, not just to step off this educational conveyor belt and to recognize that their kids will, in the long run, go further faster by pausing to learn themselves in the world outside of the academic context. But beyond that, this added challenge and opportunity of sending a young person out into the world so far from home. I've been dreaming about Global Citizen Year again from when I was 18, and I even in college was working on a thesis that then became the blueprint for Global Citizen Year, and that was 10 years before I even built and launched the organization. And I look back, and even then I recognized that I was not yet ready. I didn't have the skills or experience I needed to launch this in the way that I knew I eventually wanted to. But in some ways, I couldn't have predicted how the world was going to change as well. And I say this in response to your question because I think about the ways that text messaging and Skype have made the world feel so much smaller, safer, and more accessible. So I think that's one of the reasons that parents are more comfortable at this point sending a kid to rural Senegal or a small town in Brazil for the year is that they know they'll have that Sunday morning Skype date and that it can actually feel that their kids are not as far as they once might have seemed.
From the student's perspective, this idea of going to explore this new territory and learn a new language and all of the exciting things that lay ahead, it seems like the added stress of having to learn the language could potentially be a prohibitor. Does that does that ever come up as a question mark? Like, do I have to learn the language? I mean,
yeah.
It seems like obviously, yes, you should really learn the language of the country that you're going to be visiting.
I think
that's just polite.
It's deeply humbling. And I've had this experience in Latin America and in other parts of the world of arriving. And I think the feeling of not being able to communicate and what that forces in terms of seeing yourself through others' eyes and being patient with yourself, being dependent on others, and then over time recognizing the benefits of patience and persistence and a sort of strong and steady effort to be able to speak to people in their own languages. It is consistently one of the things that our alumni come back and are most grateful for.
How are colleges responding to this? And where in the college application cycle does this fit, if at all?
So the responses from colleges, I think, is one of the most exciting and encouraging signs that we are onto something huge. So colleges have started coming to us hungry for our alums because they know that they arrive on campus as movers and shakers. These kids have confidence, purpose, focus. Often those are things that a young person might develop during a junior year abroad, and then they come back for their senior year and suddenly they know why they're there. But from a college's perspective, the opportunity to front load this experience, it also helps address a lot of the social and emotional challenges that colleges are facing. So there's a national survey that's done among 150,000 college freshmen every year, and there are indicators of social and emotional well-being. And the most recent survey showed that 80% of kids on college campuses feel consistently overwhelmed and exhausted, that 50% feel consistently anxious, and 48% feel everything is helpless. And these stats just stop you in your tracks, and when you look at the trend, they are inching up each year. And so the colleges are desperate to figure out solutions that make sure that their students are better prepared to really engage with what they offer. One of my mentors in this work is the author of a book called Excellent Sheep, and he talks about how we're training kids to be really good at what they do. They're all moving sort of meekly in the same direction, but they have no sense of why. And his feedback to me when he learned about what we were doing was that maybe the most effective way to change the outcomes of college is to change the inputs. And so I think this is where colleges have really started to take note. We have arrangements with schools that provide financial aid and academic credit for the Global Citizen Year, others that are providing preferred admissions. We've just launched a new partnership with Tufts University, where every admissions letter last year said, "Congrats, and we now encourage you to take a bridge year." You could do it domestically, or you could go with Global Citizen Year internationally. And not only will we hold your spot when you come back, we're encouraging this actively. We'll throw in financial aid if you need it. And we believe this can be the most important step you can take to prepare yourself to thrive at Tufts.
How are you tracking the impact that this program has on those statistics that you just cited?
So very closely, I think my team likes to say that we are data crazy, and we have been from the beginning. We talk a lot at Global Citizen Year about the difference between real good and feel good in creating social change. This is one of the core things that we hope our fellows come out of their year with a clearer sense of. There's a lot of idealism among the millennial generation. There are a lot more nonprofits than there need to be. And there's a real emphasis, I think, often on starting new things because they feel good, and a real need to be looking with clear eyes at what is the evidence that you're actually having an impact on the problems you're trying to solve. And so we're walking that talk as well. We do very rigorous survey analysis, both before our fellows go, when they come back, and then we've developed with some researchers at the University of Pennsylvania a longitudinal study so that each year out of the program, we're tracking our alums across the dimensions that we care most about.
How many alum do you have now?
So our first cohort was in 2010. We started with a small group of 10 fellows. We've grown tenfold. So we've got 100 fellows out in the field today, 350 alumni from the time we began. And the first couple of classes are now finishing college and moving into careers.
And are you seeing any of the results that you're hoping for?
Oh, it's extraordinary, both at the individual level and the anecdotes, but also collectively. So, you know, I think of Ananda Day, who grew up without a whole lot of financial resources. She was one of five kids in a single father home in North Carolina. She spent her year with us in Senegal. Came back and just was a superstar at UNC as an undergrad. And I saw her recently because she's moved to the Bay Area. She's working for a really hot 3D printing startup locally. And I said, "Ananda, sort of how does this connect? You've had this passion for Africa and international development." She said, "Well, Abby, in Senegal, I learned public health is an issue. Entrepreneurship works. And I have a hunch that 3D printing can be part of the solution." And I look at how Ananda chased down a job she wanted, and I look at all of our graduating alums as they finish college. There is a sense of confidence, a sense of purpose, a sense of intentionality with their next steps, We've got Fulbright scholars, Teach for America teachers. A number of fellows, as they finish college, find resources to go back to the communities where they were working. We have fellows who've set up digital literacy labs in the Amazon, one who's back and forth to Senegal, where she's working to set up a sewing cooperative so that girls in that community have alternatives to moving to the city and leaving their families and leaving school. And it's just, it's extraordinary to see beyond the what of what they're doing, the how, the sense of purpose that infuses their work.
Abby, you have mentioned several times that this was something that you really wanted to do when you were 18, and the Peace Corps told you, you got to go to college first, then come back and talk to us. Did you do that?
I wish Global Citizen Year had existed, and it didn't. And I remember at 18 finding it so ironic that I was free to join the military. You know, if I'd been Mormon, that would have been encouraged. There are a million young Mormons who head out for their 2 years of service. But there was no humanitarian way to spend this year. I ended up going straight to college because there was so much momentum toward that, and there wasn't a clear and encouraged opportunity otherwise. But I ended up taking a year off during college, and it was the equivalent of my Global Citizen Year. I lived and worked in Nicaragua, in Brazil, and it had nothing to do with formal schooling. And yet it was the most formative part of my education. And when I came back to college and I had just 1 year left, it brought me back to that original question when I was 18, which was, why in the world do we encourage kids to sort of keep running along this path without pausing to figure out what it is they want to study and why they're going to school in the first place? And so ever since, I have been on this path of making sure that this becomes the new normal.
When you set out to launch this organization, did you go through a traditional process of developing a business plan? How did you come to it from a business standpoint?
So as I shared, it was actually a thesis I wrote in college and something that I've been thinking about since then. But I realized that I needed more experience before I would be ready to launch. And so I worked in a variety of different settings, both in the U.S. and internationally, in education, in international development. And I often found myself frustrated learning by negative example from organizations in the sort of traditional not-for-profit world. And I put that in quotes because I'd love us to rebrand it as the for-impact or the for-purpose sector, because nonprofit only says what we're not, doesn't say anything about what we are. And I was frustrated and felt like there must be a better way to develop a skill set that was going to help me launch a thriving business. And so ended up in business school. I spent 2 years at Harvard Business School, which was really where I focused on putting together the business plan and the fundamentals for what's now become Global Citizen Year.
What has been the most difficult thing about launching Global Citizen Year?
Oh, many things. I think it's learning over and over that you have to go slow to go fast. That as a social entrepreneur, our job is to intuit the way the future will be, but to recognize that there probably aren't any shortcuts and things take the time they take. My wild vision for this is that we have tens of thousands of Global Citizen Year fellows each year, and I don't see any reason that that's not possible. But I now know well enough to know that you've got to start small, grow deliberately, and that when you're trying to create a cultural shift, especially when it goes against the grain of every indicator and pressure that kids feel in their lives, that that just takes time, strategy, effort, and resilience.
What's the thing that makes a donor's ears perk up?
So we're set up as a social enterprise, which means that about half of our operating revenues come from program fees and tuition. So kids who are able to pay are paying their own way, which is terrific. And our intent is that over time, we would love for more of our budget to be covered by earned revenue streams, but we'll always maintain this really strong commitment to access and opportunity for kids from across the spectrum. I think donors are excited about what we do for two reasons. There are those who directly invest in our scholarship fund. The other reason donors tend to get excited is the bigger vision of what we're trying to do, the recognition that our education system needs to be reimagined, that we're stuck in a system that is really not serving our kids and our society well, and that Global Citizen Year is poised to be one of the solutions.
What's the best advice about leadership you've ever received?
That the most impactful, potent leaders are those who are most authentic and most true to themselves. I think it can be easy to try to imitate the people that we look up to. And instead, what I've learned is most important is piecing together the things that I admire about the people I'm learning from, but then digesting in them and expressing them in a way that are unique to me. And that if I were to just try to follow or pretend I was somebody else, it wouldn't be the most true and distinctive version of my highest leadership.
Thank you so much, Abby Falick, for joining me today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
That was Abby Falick, the founder of Global Citizen Year. As part of our inflection point, Finding Yourself, listen to my interview with Alexis Sklamberg and Dr. Sharon Ufberg of Borrowed Wisdom.
What I really wanted to find was how to wake up every day and feel fulfilled and happy. And what I found was all of this wonderful wisdom that really resonated with me, but as a 20-something, I wasn't the target audience.
That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.